looks like nobody seems to care about us. And we have done everything we could.
Korean-American families have fading hope of seeing relatives in North Korea. It's Monday, August 20th. This is VOA Asia. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Join us as well on Facebook at VOA Asia. Coming up, Google employees not happy about returning to China, overflowing misery from a dam collapse, difficult lives for refugees in Australia, new Ebola tests, and fuel from space. It's all on today's VOA Asia. Following a rapid diplomatic thaw on the peninsula, dozens of elderly and frail South Koreans gathered excitedly Sunday on the eve of their first meeting for nearly seven decades with family members in North Korea. The three-day reunion, the first for 3 years, begins today at a resort in North Korea. Millions of people were swept apart by the 1950 to 1953 Korean War, which divided brothers and sisters, parents and children, husbands and wives, and perpetuated the division of the peninsula. Since 2000, the two nations have held 20 rounds of reunions, but time is running out for many of the aging family members. More than 130,000 Southerners have signed up for a reunion since the events began, but most of them have since died. Most of those still waiting are over 80, and the oldest participant this year is 101. Over the next 3 days, the participants will spend only about 11 hours, mostly under the watchful eyes of North Korean agents with their relatives in the North. There are no Korean Americans gathered at the resort. There never have been. The North Koreans have always refused the inclusion of Koreans who have relocated to the United States. That is not to say attempts have been made to include those Korean-American families. Chahee Stanfield is the executive director of the National Coalition of Divided Families. She tells VOA Asia's Ira Melman there had been positive expectations of an agreement to bring Korean-Americans to North Korea before the recent North Korea-U.S. summit, although it was not to be. She also praised the resumption of visitations between South and North Korean families.
We are so happy that it's actually happening. But the Korean-American divided families have been excluded from the negotiation they had in between South and North in 1985. So we have never had a formal reunions, or because we have never had a formal relationship with North Korea. In 2001, there were 100,000 Korean-American divided family members in the United States. Most of them would pass away in 10 years. So right now we are at the very end of our lives. And we just had the Trump / Kim Jong-un summit in Singapore. That was our only chance we got that last chance for the reunion. And we prayed for the summit with our whole hearts. But actually, there had been some talks about the Korean-American divided families in the news media. But it all turned out to be about remains of the soldiers, which is a very important, which is also very important, but it was never about us. And then we were, we had a high hopes, and it just crashed. But here we are. We have been here for 50 years. We have been the divided family members torn apart by a bloody war. Millions of divided families, including my mother and my brothers and sisters in the United States and South Korea, and my father and my brother in North Korea, have passed away without knowing what happened to each other. And now we are all in our 80s, most of them are in their 80s and 90s. It looks like nobody seems to care about us. And we have done everything we could. Have met with the high-ranking U.S. officials in the Trump government. And we have also worked with the North Korean representatives at the UN. We have done everything we are supposed to do.
So no Korean-American families will be part of today's visitation. Is that correct?
That is correct. After the summit, we understand that the U.S. government asked the South Korean government to include us in their negotiations. So I was told that the South Korean government had tried, high-ranking officials asked the North Korean government to include us in this upcoming summit, reunion, their reunion, which is about to happen today. North Korea rejected it. We just don't know what's going on. We don't even know where we stand now.
Did you make any inquiries? Did you ask anybody at the White House or the executive branch if that had come up at all or if it even has been discussed?
We tried. We tried to reach the people we had met before the summit, but nobody's home. Nobody.
Nobody returned your calls or anything, huh?
No.
Chahi Stanfield told Ira Melman that 10 years ago there were some 100,000 Korean Americans with divided families in the United States, but that due to aging, that number had dropped to about 1,000. VOA Asia is continuing to follow up on the story. These are among some of the top Asia stories you'll currently find on voanews.com. Major quakes strike Indonesia near Tonga. U.S. adds sanctions on Myanmar forces in Rohingya abuses. Unified Korea's athletes cheered at Asian Games Spectacular. Dream or reality, Koreans to meet after decades apart. Refugees living beyond Australia's big cities face challenges. Expanded coverage of these stories and much more are found on Facebook at VOA Asia, a great place to visit, as well as the voanews.com website. Asia continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Google has been in the headlines recently, but the news was not good. The technology company left the Chinese market 8 years ago to protest Beijing censorship, but now it appears ready to return to China to toe the party line with a new search engine. But the project is shrouded in secrecy, even as Google's employees demand transparency. All this as the company tries to defend itself against accusations that it has been actively invading users' privacy, despite claiming that it doesn't. VOA's Faiza El-Masri has the story as Faith Lapidus narrates.
Hundreds of Google employees are upset at the company's decision to secretly build a censored version of its search engine for China. Sources say the project, codenamed Dragonfly, is designed to block certain websites and search terms. According to a report by the New York Times on Thursday, a new petition demanding more transparency and accountability for the project has already racked up more than 1,000 signatures. Company executives have not made any public comments yet on Dragonfly, but in a transcript seen by Reuters, Google's chief executive, Sundar Pichai, told employees that it is still very unclear whether Google would return to China, saying the development is in its early stages and that sharing any information too early could, quote, cause issues. Google was already dealing with another issue raised earlier last week following an investigative report by the Associated Press, which claimed that Google tracks users' movements even without their permission. Apps like Google Maps help users get to where they want to go. But that means the search giant requires permission from its users to pinpoint their location. The issue, as it turns out, is that Google continues to track and automatically store time-stamped location information on all its users, even when they decide to turn off permission for Google to track their location history. It's an issue that affects anyone with an Android device or iPhone running Google Maps.
There's a little icon there that now indicates that I'm hiding from Ella. She can no longer see my location.
Many apps require location data to function. There's nothing wrong with this, but you have to be very upfront with what you're doing with that data, and you have to allow people to opt out. The problem is that the more companies know about you, and location is a very important part of this, the easier they can influence you. And I think the perfect example is you express your choices. You went the extra way and went through the preferences and decided you don't want your location to be tracked, and a company is still tracking you.
That leaves many smartphone users worried about their privacy.
I don't think they have the right to collect that kind of data without asking permission.
I don't think they should without your permission. But if you, like, give your permission, like you allow them to, then it's fine.
Such privacy issues are becoming increasingly common as people rely more and more on their smartphones and online services. For writer Faiza El-Masri, I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
Happening now in Asia, a 6.9 magnitude earthquake struck the Indonesian island of Lombok Sunday, just hours after a 6.3 magnitude quake shook the island, according to the U.S. Geological Survey. Two smaller quakes were reported around the same time. There were no immediate reports of casualties or damage. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're glad you're starting out your week with us on VOA Asia. The catastrophic collapse of a dam in Laos has poured fuel onto an already fiery debate about the future of hydropower in the region. Laos has long defied warnings of the severe impacts caused by its hydropower ambitions on the Mekong River, and despite some signals of a rethink, it's unclear if even this latest disaster will change their minds. David Boyle has this report from Atapu Province in Laos.
These scenes of devastation from the collapse of a dam in Laos have only served to amplify the growing chorus of opposition to the country's vast hydropower ambitions. The ZP and Z Nam Noi disaster, the second collapse of a dam in the country in the past year, killed scores while displacing more than 7,000 people in Laos alone. The government in Vientiane sees hydropower as the ticket to economic growth for the tiny impoverished nation. It plans to build some 140 dams in total on the Mekong River and its tributaries in its quest to become the battery of Southeast Asia, according to regional water experts. Brian Eiler, an expert on transboundary Mekong River development at policy think tank the Stimson Centre, told VOA via Skype that the collapse is just one of many recent shocks to this plan.
I think that this is a signal that Laos is struggling with its overall development of the hydropower sector, and the Laos government is attempting to keep momentum going with the battery of Southeast Asia, because clearly there is no alternative present to decision makers in Laos, which is a problem. All of Laos' eggs are in one basket on this hydropower binge.
The Laos government has blamed shoddy construction and announced a review of all existing hydropower projects before any new dams are green-lighted, a move welcomed by experts like Isla. In step with the notoriously secretive practices of construction firms in the Laos hydropower industry, the South Korean company that built the dam declined to speak with VOA. Though safety concerns were not their focus, the Mekong River Commission, or MRC, had already recommended a serious rethink of hydropower development on the river when they unveiled an exhaustive impact assessment in February. The landmark six-year multi-million dollar study warned of catastrophic impacts to the Mekong Basin if present development plans went ahead unaltered.
And by 2040, the loss will increase up to nearly 40%, so almost 1 million tons of fish lost annually, with a value of $4.7 billion annually.
Not long after these warnings, Laos announced a plan to build yet another Mekong mainstream dam. And just a day after Laos announced its post-catastrophe review, MRC member countries gave their blessing to begin negotiations on a new power purchase agreement for that project. At the February MRC summit, proponents of renewables pushed serious alternatives, arguing options like solar were on the cusp of becoming cheaper, with vastly lower financial, environmental, and human risks. But there is no strong indication yet that the tragedy of this latest disaster will provide the shock needed for such alternatives to finally be taken seriously. David Boyle for VOA News in Utapu Province, Laos.
Coming up, Australia can be a tough place to find refuge. You're listening to VOA Asia.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
This news from VOA Asia, the United States intensified its sanctions against Myanmar, blacklisting four commanders and two units of security forces for their alleged role in violent campaigns against Rohingya Muslims and other ethnic minorities. Myanmar security forces are said to have engaged in ethnic cleansing and massacres. Visit VOA Asia Facebook each day for top stories and great features. See and share them. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, despite a call for more migrants and refugees to be resettled beyond Australia's big cities, new figures show finding work can be tough. Refugees from a special 2015 humanitarian intake of refugees from Syria and Iraq who moved to regional parts of Queensland have run into problems getting a job. Only one in five are employed, and some have abandoned their initial plans and moved to a large city. We hear more from Phil Mercer in Sydney.
For the last 18 months, Dalia Banani, an Iraqi refugee, has lived with her family in the Queensland city of Toowoomba, 125 kilometres west of the state capital Brisbane. She was resettled in Australia under a 2015 plan to give emergency sanctuary to 12,000 people affected by conflict in Iraq and Syria. She says she was attracted to a regional centre because of safety and work opportunities, but she's now moving to Sydney because jobs in Toowoomba have been hard to find.
We love Toowoomba, actually, but we need job. My husband can't find job because of his English. And he in Iraq worked in oil company for 19 years. If he want to start in same area, he needs maybe 5 years to learn English and work in oil companies here. He's now 45, and, you know, we haven't any money.
Statistics from the University of Technology, Sydney, show high rates of unemployment among refugees in regional parts of Queensland, including the cities of Logan and Toowoomba. About 3,500 Syrian and Iraqi refugees have been resettled in regional centres in Queensland. Jock Collins is a professor of social economics at UTS.
Of the people we interviewed, only about 20% had found jobs, and that was less in Logan and Toowoomba than it was in Brisbane. The key issue here, though, is that most are still doing English language classes.
Language problems are only part of the story for many of the refugees from Syria and Iraq. Many need medical attention before they can even think about looking for work, while some suffer the lingering consequences of torture and trauma. The Australian government and charities offer a range of resettlement services, including language class tuition and employment advice. The number of refugees accepted by Australia each year varies. In 2016, Australia granted protection visas to more than 24,000 refugees. In 2015, the figure was 17,500. Centre-left politicians in Australia believe the annual refugee quota should be increased to 50,000 people. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
This news from VOA Asia, the Asian Games are underway. Thousands of spectators cheered wildly as athletes from the rival Koreas paraded side by side behind a unification flag in a spectacular opening ceremony for the regional Olympic-style competition. All the big stories come your way through the day on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, in health news, the deadly Ebola virus continues to spread in Congo. So far, it has claimed the lives of 42 people. 5 experimental treatments are being used to help end the outbreak. VOA's Carol Pearson reports all of the treatments are safe, but scientists still don't know how effective they are.
In 1995, a patient sick with Ebola miraculously recovered. Doctors tested his blood and found that even after getting better, this man still had antibodies in his bloodstream to fight off the disease. The National Institutes of Health brought him to the United States and cloned the cells that successfully cleared Ebola. Scientists made multiple copies of this cell and found that if animals were injected, within 5 days of being exposed to Ebola, they didn't get sick. Because the antibody came from one cell, it's referred to as a monoclonal antibody. This one specifically is called monoclonal antibody 114, or MAB114, and it's now being used in the Democratic Republic of Congo to treat 5 people who have Ebola, with the hope that they will recover as well. Dr. Anthony Fauci, who heads the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases at the health agency, says just because something works in animals doesn't mean it will also work in humans.
We cannot say whether it has shown any benefit because we don't have anything to compare it with.
So far, there are no effective treatments for Ebola. Scientists are hopeful that the therapeutic antibodies could be the best way to stop the Ebola virus. An international study led by a California research institute suggests that antibodies may be valuable treatments against new viruses and could help a patient's immune system fight the Ebola virus after being infected. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
This might sound like science fiction, but the general in charge of the U.S. military's air transports across the globe says refueling and resupplying military may soon be a job that's literally out of this world. VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb has more.
Aircraft, such as tankers and cargo planes, are the military's fastest way to move fuel, people, and equipment long distances. But the general in charge of these movements tells VOA there might be a better way. Via space.
If I can resupply from space, I can go across the globe in about 30 minutes, and if I can get the cost down, which the industry thinks it can, I do truly believe that is the next step where we can really make inroads, and I can get after what's called the speed of war.
The idea of using space deliveries isn't as far out as it may seem. In fact, industry leaders focusing on spaceflight, companies Everhart hopes to partner with, are already working on it.
SpaceX is one of them. I know there's foreign ventures that are looking at this as well. Even companies like Sierra Nevada, they have their Dream Chaser launch vehicle, which could provide tremendous strategic advantage to the U.S. government.
But it's an advantage that would come with an astronomical price tag, thousands of dollars per kilo. Experts say the need to use space must outweigh these costs, perhaps only being used during the most important of missions.
For example, the incident that happened in Benghazi, Libya. Imagine if we had been able to launch a SEAL team and put them right down in that compound within 45 minutes of knowing that it was under attack. It could have made the difference.
Harrison says space resupply likely won't be available for at least 10 years. But Everhart says industry experts tell him it could be ready sooner.
And he said, we think possibly maybe in the next 2 years. The train is leaving the station and we're going to be on it. And I'm not going to be on the caboose. I'm going to be in the front.
The general says his team is already writing government proposals to make space resupply a certainty for future military mobility. Carla Babb, VOA News, The Pentagon.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. VOA Asia is a very easy program to find. We're all over the internet, iTunes and SoundCloud. We stream on VOA Asia Facebook and our website, voanews.com. We're also found on the radio, on great radio stations around Asia, like Helps Radio at Help University in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia. Our program is brought to you by some great people as well. Our director, Tracy Carter, engineer Zainab Abdel Rahman. Managing Editor Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team, including Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, and Doug Bernard. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a super day ahead.